I met Rosa Parks at the age of 17. In 1958, at the age of 18, I met Martin Luther King Jr., and these two individuals inspired me to get in the way, to get in trouble. So I come here to say to you this morning, on this beautiful campus, with your great education, you must find a way to get in the way. You must find a way to get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble. As young people, you must understand that there are forces that want to take us back to another period. But you must say that we're not going back. We made too much progress and we're going forward. There may be some setbacks, some delays, some disappointment, but you must never, ever give up or give in. You must keep the faith and keep your eyes on the prize. That is your calling. That is your mission. That is your moral obligation. That is your mandate. Get out there and do it. Get in the way.
John R. Lewis Racial Justice Case Competition is an opportunity for business students across the nation to come together and partner with corporations in order to provide recommendations on racial justice issues. And it is an opportunity also to honor the legacy and work of the Honorable Congressman John Lewis.
You must find a way to get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble.
In January 2021, the inaugural competition was a major success. We had 105 applications from 52 universities. 2,000 people registered to attend the live final round, which included 70 judges and speakers. Internships were created specifically for JLCC participants, and there were mentions in major media outlets. And $76,000 in prizes were awarded to student teams.
When people talk about racial equity, they tend to think of it as some ancillary thing as a part of a business or a business plan. If you look at racial equity as a way to drive business, you actually will come out with much higher outcomes.
All right. Thank you so much for having us today. It's such an honor to share this time and space with y'all to amplify the power of using business as a force for good and in the fight for racial justice. My name is Jasmine Burton, and I'm an Atlanta native and an accelerated candidate at Emory University's Goizueta Business School, who has the distinct pleasure of serving as the co-managing director of this year's John Lewis Racial Justice Case Competition. As you know, we have and continue to live through a time of mass change at the intersection of a public health pandemic and a civil rights movement. And seeing peers located at the seat of the civil rights movement here in Atlanta really turn the 2020 moment into a movement has been so inspiring and is actually one of the main reasons that I chose to come to Goizueta. This year, we are in the second year of the case competition, and it's expanded by bringing on more partners and schools. We have universities from across the country who have joined forces with us, Cornell University, Howard, Rice, and Yale. We also have some powerful players as well, including Accenture, IBM, Moderna, Taco Bell, and UPS, serving as a competition sponsors, as well as Momentum.ai that's provided funding for student research. Additionally, we have a host of incredible partners, including our media partner, Yahoo Finance, and our virtual event partner, Instrument, who've helped us bring this event to life. These companies not only financially supported the competition, but serve as models to help their organizations address structural racism today. We started with more than 70 applications from over 40 universities. And with the support of our amazing team, we've narrowed it down to the top five teams, all representing each of the five corporate sponsors who will present their research and recommendations today. As a reminder, our rough agenda is going to be, we're going to start off with some opening remarks from several people and then move into the finalist presentations with 5-minute scheduled breaks between each of these presentations. And you'll also hear some brief remarks from the esteemed Ambassador Andrew Young as our keynote conversation, in addition to hearing from Emory University's leadership and the founder of the John Lewis Case Competition, Willie Sullivan. Lastly, be sure to check into the John Lewis Slack channel if you haven't already, in order to chat and network and connect across our community throughout the program today. With that, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome our dean of the Goizueta Business School, Dean Setadol. Karen Setadol joined as interim John H. Harlan Dean of Goizueta Business School in May of 2020. She's a 3-time recipient of the American Accounting Association's Notable Contributions to Management Accounting Research Award as the winner of the 2020 Management Accounting Research David Solomon's Prize. She brings a synthesis of business acumen and academic expertise to her role. Karen holds a PhD in Business Administration from the University of Michigan, a Master's of Business Administration from the University of Texas, Austin, and has a Bachelor of Science in Engineering from Baylor University. She's committed to preparing principled leaders who are positively impacting the business and society that we live in today, and pushing students, faculty, and staff beyond what it is and what it could be. Please welcome Dean Setadol.
Thank you, Jasmine. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for being here today in support of our amazing students and this important initiative. At Goizueta Business School, our mission is to develop principled leaders that positively impact business and society. We work to reimagine and redefine a different, better way of doing business to solve the world's greatest challenges, and to do so with ingenuity, integrity, and grit. In all of my years in academia, I won't mention how long, this competition represents one of the most poignant examples of the power of student voice and the unbreakable intersection between business and society. I'm so proud and grateful to be part of this day and this journey. As you know, this is the second year of our competition. And before we get to our program today, I want to take a quick look back and revisit how this all came about. In the summer of 2020, in the midst of the global pandemic and immense societal unrest, a group of very talented and ambitious Goizueta students approached me with a novel idea. These students, led by 2021 alumnus Willie Sullivan, saw companies around the world sharing clear statements of support and commitment to racial equity and justice. But they knew more was needed. They wanted to see action and meaningful progress. With the dedicated support of Goizueta's faculty, staff, and corporate partners, a few months later, these students launched the first of its kind John R. Lewis Racial Justice Case Competition, named with the blessing of the Lewis family for the late Atlanta congressman and longtime civil rights legend. The competition brings together business leaders and top students from across the country to develop solutions for Fortune 500 companies who are looking to address racial inequities within their organizations and the communities they serve. As we enter our second year, we continue to see our reach and impact expand. This year, as Jasmine mentioned, we received more than 70 team entries from more than 40 universities and colleges. And today you'll be hearing from the top five teams. It truly takes a village to make this initiative a success, and many thanks are in order. First, I'd like to recognize and extend a very sincere thank you to our outstanding academic partners and their student leaders who have joined us this year. Cornell University's S.C. Johnson College of Business, Rice University's Jones Graduate School of Business, Yale School of Management, and Howard University School of Business. These partner schools were active participants in hosting events, brainstorming ideas, and connecting us with the best and brightest students, judges, and sponsors from around the country. They were instrumental in the success of this year's competition. I'd also like to thank our competition sponsors, Accenture, IBM Call for Code, Moderna, Taco Bell, and UPS, for financially supporting the initiative and serving as models in addressing structural racism in their own organizations, their industries, and the communities they serve. Thank you to Yahoo Finance and Momentum AI for helping us execute the event and shining a light on these important issues. Thank you to all the students that participated in the competition this year in the name of creating a more just and vibrant world. I'd also like to thank our Gazueta organizing team. Thank you to Lynn Siegel, our faculty lead, and our entire student team here at Gazueta Business School, with special thanks to Jasmine Burton, co-managing director, for your leadership and energy. And finally, for your tireless dedication and leadership, thank you to this year's JLCC managing director and corporate sponsor chief liaison, Keegan Baird. Keegan, you have gone above and beyond to ensure the success of this year's competition, bringing organization and a calming, thoughtful perspective to every aspect of the competition. You, Jasmine, and your entire JLCC organizing team have left your indelible mark on Gazueta Business School. We have a wonderful program in store today. It takes many hands, minds, and hearts, and a lot of hard work, but change is necessary and possible. We appreciate your partnership on this journey. I hope you are inspired to look inward and explore the ways you and your networks can drive positive change. And now, without further ado, it is my immense honor to present a message from our keynote speaker, Ambassador Andrew Young. As many of you know, Ambassador Young was an early leader in the civil rights movement and a friend of John Lewis. He served as executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and was a close confidant to Martin Luther King Jr. He later became active in politics, serving as a U.S. Congressman from Georgia, United States Ambassador to the United Nations, and the 55th Mayor of Atlanta. Since leaving office, Ambassador Young has founded or served in many organizations working on issues of public policy and political lobbying. We couldn't be more thrilled to have such an inspirational and influential leader as part of our program today. Please enjoy.
Well, I am so honored to welcome Ambassador Young to the program today. Ambassador, it's good to see you. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, I want to start with the fact that we have both lectured in Emory's John Robson program for business, public policy, and government. So my first question, Ambassador, for you is, how can business, not just government, be part of the solution to racial injustice and inequality?
Well, you know, I think that business has taken the lead. And in Atlanta particularly, before government got started, Coca-Cola, I think, came up with the slogan, "City Too Busy to Hate." Well, that was a business idea. There was in the early 60s a meeting of 12 black and 12 white businessmen. It was called the Atlanta Forum, the Atlanta Economic Forum. And they took a look at this metropolitan area and they decided what needed to be done. And I remember in 1966, when all of the nation, all of the around the nation cities were rioting, the Action Forum decided they didn't want riots in Atlanta. And they decided the way to do that was to stop it, was to create summer jobs. And I think it was something like 650 summer jobs were created within 10 days. Because the CEOs of these corporations got on the phone and called their suppliers and said, I need you to take 5 interns this summer. I need you to take 10 interns. And it didn't take them long to create a pool of 600 summer jobs. Now, that took kids out of high school who might have been hanging around the streets doing nothing, but put them in shirts and ties, and they had to go to the office every Monday morning. Many of those students ended up interning for those companies later on. One of them that I know personally ended up as the vice president of the regional office in Kansas City of the company. Now, this was from 66 to the present. So that it was good for business. To have an infusion of 600 bright high school juniors and seniors, and I guess the people who started working with them ended up sticking, and it proved to be a great engine of business. But business can make a decision. A CEO can pick up the phone. He can make a decision in 10 seconds and try it out on two or three people. And if it sounds good, he can move with it wherever he wants to. There's a lot more freedom. I learned in my first conflict racially was back in 1956 when the Klan in South Georgia wanted to, well, we were trying to run a voter registration drive and they wanted to block us, it seemed. But I went first to the mayor. He picked up the phone and called the two largest businesses. They're still there, Sunnyland Packing Company and Flowers Bakery. And those were the two largest employers. And the mayor, the business community said, we don't want any racial problems here. Let the Klan have its meeting on the courthouse steps, but make sure that the sheriff protects the voter registration drive that I was starting at my church that Sunday afternoon, next Sunday afternoon. And so we were able to change the climate with two phone calls in the business community. And it's a lot. It takes 50% or more in the Congress now, 60% to make a decision. Any CEO can touch base with two or three people in his senior staff and one or two on the board and make a decision in a matter of minutes. So business is far more powerful in dealing with social change than government.
I want to ask you now, since this program is all about, you know, John Lewis, I'm wondering if you could share a personal story about the man, something about him and about MLK that no one without your deep personal friendship would know.
Well, I think everybody knows the story of John Lewis starting out as a kid preaching to the chickens.
Yes. Yes, a great story.
What that says is that he always saw himself as a leader. Even as a little boy, he led the chickens in the backyard. But also, I came south. I was working in New York at the National Council of Churches. Had a very good job, I thought. And my wife and I saw John Lewis on the Nashville sit-in story on NBC. And while we were sitting there, relaxed, just bought a new house, laying on the floor, sharing a bottle of wine and watching the Nashville sit-in story. At the first intermission, my wife looks at me and says, "It's time for us to go home." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, we just bought this house. She said, "Yeah, sell it."
Oh, my.
I said, and do what? She said, "I don't know. Sell this house, quit your job. It's time for us to go back home." I said, "But this is home." She said, "Not for me. Home is anywhere, you know, south of, well, preferably Atlanta, New Orleans, somewhere along the deep south." And she said, "We need to be in the midst of this doing something. We can't be in New York when the movement is going on in the south." So we actually sold a house.
How about that?
We hadn't owned it 6 months. And I sold it and quit my job and came back to Atlanta with no job. Because, well, she was a teacher, and she could get a job teaching very easily, and did. And pretty soon I got a job helping Martin Luther King. But it was the influence of John Lewis in the Nashville sit-in story that made us make a decision like that on the spot. And we had two children, and one on the way.
Oh, my.
And her master's thesis was due in May. The baby was due in June, first week in June. And when we sold the house, we had to be out of it and headed back south by the 4th of July.
That's a tremendous story.
That's the influence of John mm-hmm. Lewis over the television, even.
Mm-hmm.
Because you saw something in him that was just, he was a pure, loving, decent human being. And there was a power and an innocence about it that a genuine humility that was magnetic, that attracted you to him. Dr. King had the same sort of thing. And they got to know each other when John Lewis wrote him a letter in Montgomery while the Montgomery Improvement Association was going on. And Dr. King was so impressed with the letter that he answered it and sent him money to get a bus ticket to come to visit him a weekend and go to his church. And so Martin Luther King is responsible for John Lewis as a 13, 14-year-old getting involved in civil rights. Sending him the ticket, even.
That's wonderful. Your wife saw it, MLK saw it. You made a big life change.
He was nothing. I never saw him. There was nothing showboaty about it. Mm-hmm. He was always quiet. He was always serious. At a party sometimes, he had a few little dance moves. And he, but everything was always so delicate and so understated. He was just a genuine, loving human being that loved everybody.
I want to ask you this. I'm going to ask you a question that I'm looking for one word from you, Ambassador, and it's this. You have achieved great success in your life as well as your career. Is there one word, or what one word would you choose as a guidepost for students who want to succeed?
Well, can I have two?
I'll grant you two. I'll grant you two. Sure thing.
Okay. I would say the first is vision, and the second is courage. That it doesn't pay to be courageous and dumb and wrong. I think courage requires a guideline, vision. And those are the two words that I would hold on to. Courage, Maya Angelou said that courage is the most important virtue, because without courage, none of the other virtues ever get implemented.
How important is student leadership in achieving the good work so needed in this world?
Well, we wouldn't have a civil rights movement without students. And because students have the courage and the vision, but they also have the opportunity. I mean, you will never get another opportunity in life after that you have in school, that you're with people, many of them 5, 6, 10 years, and you have a chance to grow up together. The good work comes, and it's easier when you have the least to lose. Like, I had to give up a job. You don't have to, very seldom do you get put out of school for doing something of kind in a kind. But it's also good to get organized and be able to do it. If you go to see the president of the college with a committee of 5 or 6, you're more likely to be heard than if you just jump up by yourself. So being a student leader requires some organization. It will require some discipline. And in the sit-ins, when the students here in Atlanta went to the college presidents, they said, "We agree with you, but before you make any action, we want you to sit down together and write down what it is you're trying to achieve." And then they paid to put the ad in the newspaper, a whole page ad. But that gave them a chance to focus on and to discipline their values and their vision.
Thank you. I'll give one final question for you. And that's, again, about students. What would you recommend that students who want to be leaders in fostering equity do now to try and make a larger positive impact down the road?
Well, let me say that, let me start with me and Martin Luther King.
Sounds good.
We didn't do much as students. I mean, I don't think he was ever in a demonstration as a student, and neither was I. We had fun. I mean, college was a ball.
It should be. It should be a little of that, for sure.
And I frankly think that learning to build friendships involved in sports and parties and passing your courses is a full-time job. And I don't want to make anybody feel guilty because they're not a student leader. Now, that doesn't mean that they won't be a leader as an adult, but you will know when your time comes. I have four children that are, of course, all grown now. I don't think any of them were student leaders, but they're all leaders now. And so you don't have to put yourself under the pressure. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some natural students, there's some natural people with natural leadership ability. And John Lewis was one of those. But it was also true that nobody invited him to join a fraternity. I mean, he was quiet and shy, and his leadership was expressed in the civil rights movement.
Right.
See? In college, I think Martin Luther King was, he was probably more of a playboy. But again, he finished college in 19. So it's different. I went to college very young too. And like David Dinkins, the mayor of New York, had just come back from the military. Well, he was 20 and I was 16. He was 22 when I was 16. And so we were both involved in campus activities. He was a leader and I was having a ball.
That's a good one to end on, because you know you've got to be you got to have some variety and be wide ranging and versatile. That matters too, doesn't it? Well, we appreciate you so much, your time, your service, and certainly your vision and your courage, Ambassador. Thank you so much for being a part of this program.
Thank you.
Right, everyone. Hopefully you are inspired by hearing those incredible words of the Ambassador Andrew Young. Thank you so much, Natalie, for facilitating the conversation and for sharing this time and space with us today. So as we continue through the program today, we would like to transition to our incredible finalists for their presentations, kicking it off with the healthcare track sponsored by Moderna and hosted by Rice. Please welcome Team IDEA to the virtual stage.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Kelly, and I'm here with Ali Tu, Brody, Alex, and Ray, and we are Team IDEA. We're excited to be sharing with you our recommendations for Moderna. The American health system is not created equal. For reasons such as discrimination, implicit bias, lack of access to health services or health insurance, minorities, especially Black Americans, do not receive the same level or quality of care and have poorer health outcomes compared to white Americans, even when all other factors are held constant. For instance, Black Americans have the highest death rate and shortest survival of any racial and ethnic group in the US for most cancers. A study by KFF found that 1 in 5 Black Americans had experienced race-based discrimination in the healthcare system in the past year. These health disparities are highlighted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Despite Black Americans comprising 12% of the population, they account for 14% of the COVID-19 deaths. So what can Moderna do? Today, we will walk you through our executive summary, and then we will dive into our mRNA strategy. We will follow up with implementation and wrap up with our finances, risks and mitigations, and our conclusion. Our client is Moderna, and we were tasked with strategizing how to increase awareness and understanding of mRNA technology in diverse populations, invest in diverse pipelines, include diversity and inclusion in their core values, and support community engagement within diverse communities. After analyzing our tasks, we concluded our overall objective was to figure out how Moderna could use these four areas to improve trust and promote health equity in diverse communities. Our team decided on an inside-out approach, starting internally within the company with their core values, and then developing diverse pipelines, and extending outward to engaging with the community and educating diverse populations. We felt the most effective way to make a difference outside of the company is to first establish those values within. One of our survey respondents said, "A company can show they are trustworthy through their investments in people, communities, social initiatives, their research and development process, as well as marketing campaigns. Also, I trust the company more when their executive board or key decision makers are diverse. That shows me that the company cares about what various cultures, genders, and other representative groups have to offer." Our team recommends the mRNA strategy: modify, grow, engage, and educate. We recommend Moderna modifies its current values and mindsets to include diversity and inclusion and reflect a culture of transparency and belonging. Grow Moderna's current pipelines to promote a more diverse workforce with a goal of a 35% increase in Black employees. We recommend Moderna engages with 13 diverse communities in the next 3 years to give back and try to directly reduce health disparities in underserved communities. And last, we recommend Moderna reach out to educate 6.4 million Black Americans about mRNA technology each year to foster understanding and build trust. I'm going to pass it off to Ali too to discuss the Modify initiative of our mRNA strategy.
Thank you, Kelly. So going from the inside out, for the first part of our strategy, we're focusing on modifying the current values. To see real change, we believe it is of extreme importance that DEI efforts go beyond Moderna's CSR strategy and as a small section on our careers website. We believe that for real change to occur, DEI should be embedded as part of Moderna's DNA, in their strategy and in their culture. So let's take a quick look at the current status. Moderna currently has four values: being bold, curious, collaborative, and relentless. And in addition, Moderna has 12 mindsets, which represent how the company makes their decisions, how they prioritize their work, and how they build Moderna for the future day by day. These mindsets are centered around the company's values, but we found that while these mindsets translate those values into actions, they do not touch upon collaboration and being inclusive in the workplace. So there is an opportunity for improvement here. In addition, our survey results show us that the general public thinks there could be more transparency in the industry as a whole. So what we suggest as a solution is for Moderna to go even beyond diversity and inclusion to create a culture where minorities feel that they truly belong in, to be able to project that to the outside and ultimately generate impact. So how could Moderna achieve this? First, by creating a culture of transparency. The first step that we suggest will be to audit all policies and practices for potential current biases and to be able to remedy them to ensure that there is a safe space for DEI conversations to occur in the workplace. We recommend also looking at these internal practices through the lens of the 4/5 rule. Then we recommend to add a 13th mindset: we embrace diversity. Lastly, for the external public, we suggest that Moderna remodels its website, adding a dedicated DEI page that will detail Moderna's efforts, including DEI metrics and ERG information. This should also include testimonials from its members, and we think if it's easy to navigate and it includes clear statements from the leadership team, it will be very impactful. We also suggest that the company improves its search engine optimization, or SEO, so that the general public can easily find the information when they're looking for it. This will be particularly important for candidates who are external to the company, and this leads us to our second initiative that Brody will cover.
Thanks, Ali, too. Now, judges, I'm going to walk you through the next initiative of our strategy, Grow, which is how we plan to build a diverse organization. But before I get started, I want to highlight three current issues Moderna is facing that we will be addressing. First, a demographic diversity issue. Currently, we estimate that at Moderna, only 8% of employees self-identify as Black. Second, a geographic diversity. Of the 3,000 Moderna employees on LinkedIn who have their universities attended listed, 100% of those universities are located in the Northeast region of the United States. And third, the current recruiting pipeline at Moderna. Moderna has experienced an unprecedented growth over the past few years, requiring them to hire from their personal networks to keep up with hiring demands. So let's take a look at the benefits of having a diverse workforce. We have identified four business benefits that Moderna will gain from having a diverse workforce. First, it creates a better understanding of the needs of all customers. Second, it creates a dissent within a company. Third, it increases employee satisfaction and production. And lastly, improves financial performance. But most importantly, diversity within a company will increase trust in diverse communities. So for our GROW initiative, we are taking a two-pronged approach. Our first component of our initiative is to attract. We plan to target top STEM HBCUs in the nation. The second component of our initiative is to promote. We recommend introducing a Moderna Tech Leadership Development Program to execute this component of our strategy. By implementing our two-pronged approach, Moderna will build a diverse pipeline and retain diverse talent, resulting in an increase in Black management and a 35% increase in Black employees. So let's get into the attract component of our GROW initiative. For rollouts in year one and two, we plan on targeting Howard, Hampton, and Florida A&M. After successfully targeting these schools, in year three, we recommend adding two more schools, North Carolina A&T and Morgan State, to our HBCU school list. These schools are the top five listed STEM HBCUs in the nation. So how do we plan on getting our foot at the door at these schools? First, we recommend hiring a third-party diversity consulting firm to assist with HBCU recruitment training. We want to ensure Moderna recruiting teams have all the necessary information and are up to speed on the best practices to recruit at these schools. Second, we want Moderna to leverage their Black ERGs to give virtual webinars at these HBCUs. And third, we want to build a strong on-campus presence to establish a strong rapport with the career services and with the students that attend these schools. So what are our goals from this initiative? What do we hope to get out of this? Well, firstly, we hope to hire 84 Black employees over the course of 3 years to reach our goal of increasing diversity at Moderna by 35%. And we hope to establish a strong recruiting pipeline at these schools with at least one hire from each of these five target schools. Now, I want to take you through the promote component of our GROW initiative. The best way to promote talent is to create an LDP, or a leadership development program. We recommend creating an LDP for the Moderna Tech Center. It was announced last May that Moderna plans to more than double the size of the lab space and turn it into an industrial tech center. We believe that this exciting news will be a great attraction to make this LDP not only popular, but a competitive program. So we recommend Moderna, it will be targeting external candidates for this LDP, but also leave it open for employees currently at Moderna to apply for this as well. So this LDP will be a two-year program, spending 6 months in its manufacturing, quality control, supply chain, and tech development. After the successful rollout of this LDP in the first graduating class, we hope to add three more traditional LDPs at Moderna, one in marketing, one in finance, and one in HR. So what are the benefits of having this LDP? Well, upon graduating, employees will become a senior level manager and have built the hard and soft skills needed for continuous career growth. By implementing our attract and promote components of our GROW initiative, Moderna will be able to attract and retain diverse talent at a high level. Now, I'm going to pass it back to Ali Tu to take you through the Engage initiative.
Thank you, Brody. So one of our survey respondents said that companies can demonstrate their commitment to helping people through nationwide assistance programs. And for part three of our strategy, we focused on how Moderna can act as a partner in promoting trust and health equity through community engagement. Businesses can do their part by focusing on preventative care and supporting health education campaigns. But why is community engagement such a key factor in promoting health equity? Because everyone has the right to know about their risks to their health and to their well-being. And sadly, not everybody has the opportunity to access that information. So better informed people can make better decisions when it comes to their health. And community engagement has a more meaningful and longer lasting impact than community outreach, because that is more short term. With that information, the initial goal for this community engagement initiative that we're proposing would be to engage with 13 communities in the next 3 years with a focus of health education and health promotion. We recommend starting in Suffolk County, which has the highest Black population in Massachusetts, and this is the state where Moderna operates. So the goals can then be reviewed and set every 5 years after that. The main outcome of this initiative is that it is a solid step towards advancing health equity. Now, going into our initiative in more detail, from an internal perspective, we suggest hiring a director of community engagement to gradually improve the level of involvement with the communities, going from outreach to involvement to collaboration. And this would be the perfect link for Moderna to work along with the Moderna Foundation once it begins its operations. For additional support during those event days, we also suggest expanding Moderna Volunteer Week to an ongoing opportunity so that employees can participate. By engaging with the diverse communities, Moderna can give back and support efforts to reduce health disparities. And we believe that this is one way that Moderna can exemplify their passion for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, from an external perspective, Moderna should establish partnerships with local health officials and non-for-profits. And lastly, partnering with local community centers and churches to host the events at their locations, because this will also play an important role in establishing that trust with the community. Data from our research also showed that African Americans are more likely to die from heart disease and to suffer from high blood pressure at younger ages than their white counterparts. But this risk can be reduced with preventative care. So for this, our recommendation for the first events in the outreach stage include providing health-free screenings for blood pressure, blood sugar, and also encouraging the attendees to follow up with our community health centers or with our private health providers. We believe that this will also open the window for Moderna to initiate a dialogue, to establish trust, and to begin building the relationship with the community. Moving to the involved stage, getting their feedback, and lastly, being able to incorporate Black-owned businesses into these events for ultimate impact and really supporting the community. Continuing with our Inside Out strategy, I will now pass it on to Alex to cover the Educate initiative.
Thanks, Ali, too. Our Educate and Engage initiatives work in parallel to build trust, allowing Moderna to increase awareness of mRNA technology in diverse communities and encourage brand association between Moderna and mRNA technology. When asked what was the first word that comes to mind when you hear Moderna, Black respondents' top answers were vaccine, COVID, and medicine. 32% of African Americans stated that they were not familiar with mRNA technology, and 48% didn't know that Moderna's COVID vaccine used it. In addition, we took the time to hear personal accounts through focus groups composed of Black millennials and Gen Zs, and their quotes included, "I can't relate to Moderna's brand. Moderna's social media content isn't engaging. I don't see myself in their videos. It seems to have information that's easy to understand, but there's just no connection." This shows that there's a lack of awareness and engagement on mRNA tech, and Moderna should fill this gap. mRNA technology promises to revolutionize the future of vaccines by offering a fundamentally different approach to treating diseases like cancer, HIV, and respiratory illnesses like the flu. Increasing awareness and knowledge on mRNA tech will increase the confidence in the effectiveness and safety of the vaccines, lower vaccine hesitancy, and improve health outcomes, which will result in an increase in health equity. Our Educate initiative will increase awareness and knowledge of mRNA technology through our Empower mRNA campaign. In order to create culturally authentic messages, we recommend forming a strategic partnership with Burrell Communications, a minority-owned PR firm that strives to improve communities by increasing awareness through transcultural messaging. To meet people where they are, the Empower mRNA campaign will focus on mass media channels, such as social media, using hashtag EmpowerMRNA, as well as traditional marketing to deliver content on mRNA tech. In partnership with Burrell, the hashtag EmpowerMRNA campaign will partner with social media influencers to create engaging content and integrate information on mRNA tech, leveraging influencers' current social media followings to create viral exposure and address the spread of false information on social media that plays a large role in vaccine hesitancy and decision-making. We propose focusing on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube to take advantage of their short video formats, as well as the respective algorithms on each platform. Additionally, creating TV communications that successfully reflects cultural backgrounds, like focusing on family, faith, and experiences with dynamic storytelling while providing information on mRNA tech, will improve engagement and increase awareness. Now I will pass it on to Ray to go over finance, risk, and mitigations.
Thank you, Alex. Next, I will be detailing the costs and benefits of our strategy. I will also spend some time discussing the foreseen risks and how we recommend mitigating them. Here is a breakdown of the cost of our initiatives. The total cost of our strategy is $17.4 million in present value terms. The Educate and Grow initiatives account for 82% of this figure. The biggest part of our strategy is the Educate initiative, or the Empower mRNA, social media, and other media campaigns whose goal they are to increase awareness of mRNA technology. The second biggest part of our strategy is the Grow initiative, i.e. the HBCU targeted recruitment and the leadership development programs. However, with these combined investments come revolutionized values at Moderna around diversity and inclusion, a more diverse workforce, increased trust from diverse communities, and according to a 2017 Deloitte case study, companies with inclusivity in hiring, promotion, development, and leadership generate up to 30% higher revenue per employee and greater profitability than their competitors. So what are the foreseen risks of our strategy and how do we recommend to mitigate those risks? One big risk is culture resistance. Company culture is something that is felt more than measured. In essence, an organization's culture is the shared perception of how things are done. We recommend getting employees and executives on board. Successful culture change relies on including your employees in the transition and getting their feedback. This can be achieved through a change management strategy, which we suggest being managed by the HR department. A second meaningful risk is the current competitive recruitment environment. This risk can be mitigated by the potential to work in the new state-of-the-art industrial Moderna Tech Center. Another mitigating factor is our recommendation of highly competitive compensation packages. The two final risks we identified were staying relevant with the external facing content and meeting the needs of the community. A similar risk is not reaching your target audiences. We recommend mitigating those risks through community feedback mechanisms and through employing the expertise of the Burrell PR team and the Director of Community Engagement. Now here is Kelly with some closing statements.
Thank you, Ray. The American healthcare system is not created equal, but Moderna is taking strides to reduce these inequalities. We listen to the voices of the people. The information from our survey, focus group, and subject matter expert interviews inspired our mRNA strategy. Moderna can act against these inequalities by reforming within and extending that reform outward. By modifying a culture that embraces diversity and is transparent in their intentions, they can begin hiring and growing diverse employees that will encourage trust from diverse communities. With this established trust, Moderna can take it a step further to actually engage with the community and show they care about their health and what they have to say. Last, Moderna can educate diverse populations about mRNA technology and increase their understanding of it. These initiatives combined will allow Moderna to establish trust within diverse communities and play a part in reducing health disparities. On behalf of Team IDEA, I want to thank you all for being here today and listening to our recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Team IDEA, for your presentation. Your research and recommendations and insights were really inspiring. And what a great way to dive into our finalist presentations for today. So we're about 10 minutes ahead of schedule, which is great. So we're going to actually reconvene at 2 p.m. EST. So that's about 10 minutes before we go into our next finalist presentation. We invite you to, again, stay in communication with our community on Slack. So be sure to do that if you haven't already. And we'll see you again in 10 minutes. All right, everyone. Hopefully you had an opportunity to connect and chat on Slack and have a bit of a break. Next up, we have the Consulting and Professional Services track, sponsored by Accenture and hosted by Emory University. Please give a warm virtual welcome to Team Disruption.
Awesome. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the John Lewis Case Competition for 2022. My name is Aaliyah, and Shanae, Michael, Katie, and I make up Team Disruption, disrupting the norm and using JLCCC as an opportunity to engage with key business leaders and positively impact issues on racial injustices. For the next 20 minutes, we're going to walk you through the healthcare disparities within the US, introduce our problem statement and how we went about solving it, our three-pronged solution, financial and implementation considerations, and lastly, our final thoughts. Since 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected us all. We saw how Black and Brown people were disproportionately affected and died at higher rates compared to our white counterparts. Even over the Xmas break, we saw how COVID affected our classmates and even some of our significant others that serve as doctors who attend patients. We all had our struggles with healthcare within this country. And for some, the global pandemic shed light on the disparities of access for healthcare. But for Black and Brown communities, this is something that we've known all along and have been experiencing for years. This is why we decided to focus on the health and public sector. It is something that we're passionate about It's relevant to us all, and it's been affecting all of us for a long time. This led us to our question, within the healthcare industry, how can we lessen the inequity of quality of care between Black, Indigenous, people of color, and white people? Now on to Katie. Please take us through a brief history of inequities within the healthcare system within the United States.
Thanks, Aaliyah. The disparities within healthcare have lasted for centuries. In the 1800s, Black Americans were experimented on without their consent. In the mid-1900s, people of color were infected with things like plutonium and syphilis for doctors to see what the effects on the body, up through to today, where we continue to have policies that marginalize communities of color. This has all led to a distrust between communities of color and the healthcare industry, and it is imperative that we address this issue now. The solutions we're presenting today will address the disparities within healthcare. Black women today are 3 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women, and Black and Brown Americans are over 2 times as likely to die of the impacts of COVID-19. We know that there is an urgent need to address this problem, and we are excited to present our solutions today. We conducted focus groups and surveys to identify our problem statement. That is both an urgent and topical need, and through our research found the highest levers to meet the needs that we identified. Through further research into the work of Accenture, we learned that Accenture already has strong foundations that we can build off of to really make an impact. First, access. We are recommending that Accenture build on their AI virtual care assistant, Ella, to better meet the needs of BIPOC communities. Next is training. Through harnessing the power of virtual reality, we are going to equip hospitals with better DEI training that is both actionable and will have positive impacts on the quality of care for patients. And lastly, advocacy. We're recommending that hospitals hire a staff member that is solely responsible for the fidelity and implementation of this program that Accenture will train. We're excited by these solutions because they are both actionable and feasible. We conducted a focus group with over 10 individuals from the healthcare value chain, from insurance workers, medical school students, critical care workers, pharmacies, and hospitals. And we determined that access, advocacy, and training from their feedback are the biggest levers to make a strong impact in the quality of care. We also decided on hospitals within the healthcare industry to develop these actionable solutions. In order to create the biggest positive impact, though, we needed to ensure that we also heard from healthcare recipients. So we sent out a survey to over 350 patients across the country to make sure we heard their voices. And we heard a very similar story that access, advocacy, and training are the biggest levers that will also impact and make a more positive experience for them. To guide us through our solutions today, we're going to be telling the stories of 3 individuals, Sylvia, Kwame, and Sam. And I'm now going to pass it to my teammate, Michael, who is going to start us off with Sylvia's story of access.
Thank you, Katie. I want to introduce you to Sylvia, a Mexican immigrant who speaks very limited English. She is currently in pain and unsure whether she can go to the nearest clinic or not. Unemployed and uninsured, Sylvia is unaware of the options available to her as she is preoccupied with caring for her grandson. Sylvia is not alone though. One of 28 million United States residents are uninsured. Hispanics or Latinos make up about 13 million of the uninsured, with African Americans following up with roughly 5 million, compared to 2 million uninsured white Americans. For Sylvia and millions of Americans, they are inhibited by so many hurdles in order to access quality healthcare outside of insurance. Barriers to access to quality care come in many forms, such as language barriers, age, lack of financial resources, and limited access to healthcare and resources could be life and death for some individuals. Our proposed solution for mitigating many of these barriers that Sylvia and many Americans are experiencing is to extend the capabilities of Accenture's Intient Intelligence Patient Platform. This platform is a supporting technology for Accenture's suite of outcomes-based patient services, enhanced by Ella, an AI bot virtual care assistant for patients that provides medication reminders, vitals tracking, and appointment scheduling. This information enables life sciences companies to provide patients with a personalized, interactive way to manage their health and engage with their care team members. We saw this as an amazing opportunity and solution whose capabilities could be expanded to further enhance patient health experience and serve a dent on health disparities that we have discussed. The first expansion is for Ella to provide local transportation options to show patients alternate or possibly cheaper modes of transportation locally available to them. The second expansion, Ella will provide health insurance recommendations based on multitude of factors to include their socioeconomic status. Lacking health insurance related knowledge and skills or health insurance literacy puts people at risk of choosing an insurance product that could fail to provide needed benefits or protect them financially. When I think of health insurance recommendations, I think about my family when they immigrated to America and they had to come up with creative solutions to take care of my two siblings. And the third expansion, Ella will help connect patients to an appropriate advocate. Providing patients with options for advocacy can help ensure that a patient's feedback on their preferences, desired outcomes, and experience of care is integrated into care delivery and enables people to effectively manage their own care and services. Finally, Ella will provide language support in order to help break down language barriers and empower patients to participate in their own care. With this solution, we can support Sylvia by mitigating some of those barriers to access and giving her the options she and many other Americans need. Furthermore, we understand that creating the solution is only part of solving the problem. The other part is making sure people are aware of the problem, of the platform, excuse me. In our appendix, we craft the solution to meet our target audience where they are to increase awareness. And I would love to introduce you to Shanae to talk about training and to meet Kwame.
Thank you so much, Michael. Kwame suffers from sickle cell anemia and frequently experiences pain episodes. Today, his upper back pain is more intense than usual. So naturally, he goes to the hospital for care. But when he goes to the hospital and describes his symptoms, he's met with the statement, "You don't look ill to me." For those of you who don't know, sickle cell anemia is a red blood cell disease that affects primarily African Americans in the United States. The disease causes painful episodes that are intense and vary in intensity. These patients desperately need help when they come to the hospital. But yet, because of bias and assumptions on addiction, doctors and nurses are hesitant to give these patients the care they need to manage their pain. In fact, in a survey taken of sickle cell nurses, 63% of the nurses found that they believe that addiction manifests itself in sickle cell patients, which is not true. And 30% of those nurses didn't want to give those patients pain medication. We believe that with a little bit more training on implicit bias, we can really help these patients so they feel heard when they reach the hospital. From our research, we found that current implicit bias training is often impersonal and often focuses only on awareness. Our proposed training program includes discussion and will allow doctors and nurses the opportunity to utilize the safe environment of virtual reality to test alternate scenarios and strategies and see things from a different perspective. Our program will start with discussion, go to virtual reality role play, come back for strategy development, back to simulation so that they could practice those new tools, and we'll end on evaluation. Our evaluation will be based on how the strategies are being implemented, whether they're being used, and finally, how the patient care is being affected. Thankfully, from our research, we found that Accenture has a similar platform called Avenues. Avenue stands for Accenture Virtual Experience Solution. They currently use this solution to help new trainees within the caseworker field. They have seen great success in helping these caseworker trainees feel more confident when they start the job. We believe that that can have a similar or more or even better impact within healthcare because doctors and nurses make such strong, big decisions that impact so much more than a patient's health. It is imperative that they get this training. and virtual reality in healthcare is already being used. Virtual reality is being used right now to teach doctors how to do surgery. We just ask that they do it for implicit bias training. And from a technological needs perspective, all we need is Wi-Fi and an Oculus headset to be able to successfully run the software. Can you imagine how different Kwame's experience would have been if these doctors and nurses had the sensitivity training to be able to better handle his situation? Next slide. And finally, I'd like to introduce you to Sam. Sam is the new program manager of health equity, and her job is simple: to make sure that the changes that we talked about are implemented, that progress is being made, and to look for ways to continuously improve. If we tie it back to Sylvia and Kwame, for Sylvia, she can make sure that she gets the care she needs, regardless of whether or not she speaks English. And for Kwame, she can make sure that the next time he comes to the hospital, he's not met with doubt and reluctance, but is met with the treatment and care that he needs. We believe that Sam is an integral change that needs to be made to the organizational structure of a hospital to really bridge the gap in care. And so as Sam is being hired to support the hospital, we found that through our research, if there is a DEI initiative, it's usually on the doctors to discover the error, implement solutions, and make sure that change gets executed. That would now fall on the shoulders of Sam, and Sam would be able to take all of that work off of the doctor's shoulders so they can focus on care. From a training perspective, this is where Accenture can play a huge role. Accenture Change Management Program can help train Sam to utilize these new tools in AI and VR to get the full extent of what it offers so that she can drive the patient care experience. And finally, because Sam is making so many decisions, we know she can't be successful without the support of senior management. It is imperative that senior management supports Sam and encourages buy-in across the board so we can really close that patient care gap. I think now that you've heard the stories of Sylvia, Kwame, and Sam, I'm going to pass it off to Michael, who's going to wrap it up with key considerations.
Thank you, Shanae. For our solutions, four key implementation factors that must be considered is privacy and security, integration into existing systems, mitigating a digital divide, and updating data. Changing existing systems requires careful change management. To do this, the right leaders must be in place to support and facilitate that change. People lack trust in how their data is being used and may not have the platforms to access the technology. Therefore, it is crucial that organizations prioritize transparency and the technology ensures broadband access to all. Finally, the data utilized in our solution must continue to be relevant and up to date in order to remain effective.
Since our solutions are based on adapting current technologies, we see the cost to Accenture as very minimal, but the potential of entering this new space is going to be huge. For access and training, since they require AI and virtual reality software respectively, we consider the cost to include implementing, building, and developing this software, as well as the human capital needed to make these changes happen. For training, we consider the cost to include time, resources for training, and assisting hospital staff. For our revenue potential, we see our three-pronged solutions as sellable work in three industries, five different service offerings, and 10 plus capabilities. To learn more about that, check out our appendix. Currently, Accenture's revenue within the commercial sector of health and public service is around $3.3 billion. We predict with the additional AI and virtual reality softwares, Accenture can grow at an additional 2% within this. Our projected revenue growth rate of 2% is based on the 5% market share of the United States hospitals, with pricing for AI valued at $5,000 per month with a $10,000 initial startup, and the price for virtual reality starting at $90,000, which is normal for VR training. The core of Accenture's growth strategy is providing a 360 value to their clients, people, and communities. We see our three-pronged solution as providing impact to patients, healthcare workers, and families. What makes our solution so great is the feasibility by using existing resources, the minimum upfront cost, and the potential to make huge impact. For access, of the 28 million that are uninsured, 18% said that the reason they didn't sign up for insurance is because they couldn't find a plan that met their needs. Now, imagine if Ella, an AI bot, was able to leverage their resources and data and provide solutions for those. We'll be able to make a huge dent in the access to the disparities for access to healthcare. For training, in our research, we found that Avenues was successful in making 75% of caseworkers feel better prepared and more successful at their jobs. Taking that number and applying it to a state like Georgia, the virtual reality experience has the potential to positively impact over 127,000 healthcare workers. And lastly, for advocacy, in a poll conducted, 7 out of 10 African Americans said they were treated unfairly within the healthcare system, and 55% said they didn't trust it. That's quite a bit. Now imagine if we had someone like Sam, someone whose sole purpose is to focus on healthcare equity. We can begin to build back trust within our communities and make that change, because we know that we're there to support them. As mentioned before, this project was personal to us. We all have had someone that's been affected by the healthcare disparities within this country. For me, it was seeing my mother, who was, while going through cancers, the doctor accidentally operated on the wrong side of the breast and showed no empathy afterwards. For Shanae, it's watching her two immigrant mother parents try to find affordable, accessible healthcare for her grandmother. And for Katie, it's watching her students trying to navigate healthcare solutions within this country. And for Michael, it's watching his two immigrant parents find creative solutions for their three children. We want to thank you all for joining our solution today. Thank you.
All right, we're moving right along with such an incredible program this afternoon with so many brilliant and bold ideas from peers across the country. So it's really inspiring to be in community with y'all. So transitioning next, we're going to be on the transportation and logistics track, sponsored by UPS and hosted by Howard. We are pleased to introduce the Racial Justice League.
Thank you, Jasmine. Good afternoon, everyone. We are very honored to be here for the finals of the John R. Lewis Racial Justice Case Competition. We are the Racial Justice League.
Hello, I'm Khadijah Bryson Van.
My name is Rio Dennis.
And I'm Kelly Lewis.
Today, we'll examine how UPS can attract women and minorities into the transportation industry. Since its inception, UPS has maintained ingenuity. Founded by two teams, the organization has since grown to maintain it to improve its size, impact, and foster programs that really focus on equity and a sense of belonging. Yet, similar to many organizations, they have been impacted by changes in demographic, workforce preferences, and employee needs. To combat this, we recommend that UPS implement a multifaceted recruiting and retention approach. We suggest through four programs, the Young Adult Apprenticeship Program, the Rotational Program, Referral Plus Program, and Unified Rewards Program, that UPS brings all these programs together. These programs will help to bring UPS back to its original demographic of young adults, decrease employee turnover and its associated costs, and strengthen the prevalence of D&I in the workplace. Next, we'll have Kelly, who will go into how we actually did our methodology.
Thank you, Khadijah. We utilized a wide array of primary and secondary research sources. Our primary sources included a survey of the general public targeted at working-age people of color in the U.S., as well as personal interviews of current and former UPS employees and people in the logistics industry. Our second secondary sources included several UPS surveys, reporting on the rate of turnover within UPS, as well as journal, news, and other scholarly articles. In our research, UPS performed well in the areas of hiring speed and loyalty. At least 60% of people of color and women who are full-time employees at UPS feel a sense of community and belonging and are likely to recommend UPS to friends and family. However, there were also several areas where UPS is actively working to address gaps. UPS has made several key changes to improve diversity and inclusion, including hiring their first Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer, Charlene Thomas, who may be here today. But there is still room to grow. Second, most of the public did not know about the varied opportunities for work at UPS and all of the benefits that come along with that. And third, UPS has a higher than industry average turnover rate, about 75% in their part-time package workforce year over year. So we aim to address these three areas of opportunity with our presentation today. And I'll hand it off to Rio to walk through a little bit more detail.
Thank you, Kelly. To provide a further illustration as to UPS's current pipeline to retention, we start here on the left as a representative of the general public. And let's say it's about 100 people. Based on our general public survey, we found that 79% of people think of jobs in the transportation industry as a good, great, or excellent job, which leads us down to 79. We then found that there's a major jump of 43% of people actually having being familiar with UPS jobs. Can click through. That leaves us down to 34 people remaining in the applicant pool. We then found that 15% of the people with transportation industry experience actually rated UPS as the best place to work in transportation, which actually would have led us to 5 people remaining. But for the sake of this, we're going to double that to 10, saying about 10 people still actually apply and get accepted to a job at UPS. However, we then found that the turnover data is that 66% of those hired will quit within the first 12 months. With the remaining 4, 3 of them will actually stay with UPS for greater than 4 years, going back to that loyalty point that Kelly just mentioned. And so part of our solutions wanted to focus on two key bottlenecks in this process, which is first, the 43% of respondents who are extremely or very familiar with UPS jobs, and really trying to focus on the recruitment side and expanding the knowledge of UPS opportunities. And secondly, at the end, with the 66% who are quitting within the first 12 months. As we know, turnover can be very costly. Within the past year, UPS has spent over $152 million on training due to their high turnover rate. And specifically, we found that 31% of the total UPS US workforce resigned within past year, within 2021. There's a lot of money being invested into training that is then going down and not being utilized as people are just leaving within the next few months. And so to start things off, we're gonna start from our recruitment standpoint. And we found that our goal is to try to achieve 50,000 diverse candidates by the end of 2023. While we think this is a pretty bold goal, we want to do this through the creation of the UPS University programs that are focused on recruiting a younger workforce, as well as women and people of color. We want to get back to that history component that Khadija talked about earlier, with UPS being founded by two teenage entrepreneurs. By doing partnerships with different technical schools, non-government organizations, and nonprofit organizations, UPS can really start to get more of that younger demographic, and especially women, people who identify as gender non-binary, and people of color, using the You Belong at UPS strategy. First of which is our Young Adult Apprenticeship Program. This will help for us to recruit younger talent, specifically through our drivers and non-drivers program. Through the non-drivers program, we'll actually be able to capture more of that teenage demographic with the ages of 18 to 24. And with the drivers program, it will be targeted between the ages of 21 and 24. Through both of these programs being a one-year program, the drivers program will focus more on people who are on track to become package car and freight truck drivers, while the non-drivers program will focus on operations and non-operations roles. Both will be provided with mentor opportunities, as well as the opportunity to attend the Career Pivot Learning Series, which Esther will talk to more about later. Finally, they will both get access to the $25,000 tuition assistance, which UPS is already offering its employees, to be able to go towards technical schools as well. Specifically, we some ideas of partnerships is with the Tennessee College of Applied Technology in Memphis, which has a fully funded CDL program, as well as the Atlanta Technical College, which has a new transportation and warehousing program. This actually replicates a new partnership that UPS just started on the West Coast with East LA College as well. Now is the time for UPS to get involved in apprenticeship model, because back in December 16, 2021, the U.S. Department of Labor actually kicked off a 90-day trucking apprenticeship challenge. And with 54 days left in the challenge, now is the time for UPS to get involved, as FastForward is actually helping companies get their apprenticeship programs up and running in as little as 48 hours. The U.S. Department of Labor also allows for registration of a number of other occupations within the transportation industry. While there are a vast number of benefits to the apprenticeship model, there's one key one we wanted to focus on specifically for UPS, which is the enhanced employee retention. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, 91% of apprentices who finish their program are still employed 9 months later. They actually provided a specific case with Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina, who registered their apprenticeship program back in 2009, and actually found that for that program specifically, their turnover rate was 4% in comparison to 13% being the industry average. They also found that people who went through their program had an average tenure of nearly 10 years, and 22% of them are now in senior leadership positions at Blue Cross Blue Shield. And this is a trajectory we want to see UPS have. Being able to bring in having a stable pipeline to bring in qualified and diverse workforce and actually see them build during their time at UPS. And so now I'm going to pass it on to Esther to go more into our rotational program.
Thank you, Rio. We at Racial Justice League would like to introduce to UPS two different rotational programs that would help enhance and increase diversity, equity, and inclusion at UPS. We want to introduce the career entrance program for our gap year program and our career returners program, the returnship program. Since the pandemic, hiring for entry-level college graduate positions has fallen by 45%. On average, 43% of college graduates are underemployed in their first job. Two-thirds of these graduates continue on after your fifth year to 10 years, still remain underemployed for the next 5 years and the next 10 years. This continues to increase economic disparities among people of color. And we believe that with an entrance program like the Gap Year program, UPS can help support career entrance in this space. For our returners, 57% of male and 74% of female millennials anticipate a career break. However, when they're coming back into the workforce, we still see gaps in their resume, which actually become pain points for them to actually enter into the job industry. We know that life happens and they should not be penalized for this. So we'd like to introduce the UPS Returnship Program to support this initiative as well. Our eligibility for both programs for career entrance are students and candidates with about 2 to 4 years of university to apply for the program. It's going to be a rotational program with a 6-month stint for an operational and non-operational roles. And we do believe that UPS can partner with organizations like Parachute Bridge and Gap Year Association to support and underpin this program. On our returnship strategy, we would like to focus on returning workers who have at least two years of work experience and at least 2 years out of the labor force. And we would also like UPS to invite the UPS alumni to be a part of this program. This program will be in a cohort program format, about 26 weeks. And we believe that this program will be crucial because especially women are high in the retention population, and we want to invite them back into the program and transition them seamlessly. There are two different partnerships that UPS can partner with, iRelaunch and PathForward. These programs are experts in this space, and we believe that by UPS leaning on these experts, UPS can be successful in launching both the Gap Year program and the Returnship program. So what are the benefits of these programs? These programs have numerous benefits, and we believe that it would certainly attract the multifaceted talent lifecycle and enable people in the program to explore and discover their purpose to grow with UPS. Returnships and the Gap Year program for entrants sent a clear message that UPS values this workforce and all the unique perspectives that they bring to the table. It's an opportunity to close the economic gap among these populations. And at the end of the day, UPS will have a strong and reliable pipeline of career entrants and returners who are loyal to UPS. All of these programs, what Rio has mentioned around the apprenticeship program, as well as the rotational program, will be underpinned by a career pivot learning series, which is a lunch and learning series that we would like to introduce to really create a cohort environment where UPS candidates in the programs can actually lean on each other and lean on their colleagues, as well as really understand the benefits and the incentives that come with having a job at UPS. So how much will this cost UPS? We believe this will cost slightly over $500,000, but we believe the benefits far outweigh the cost. The reason for a lot of the cost, especially the lion's share of the cost, will be within the rotational program, because we would like to introduce a travel component for our Gap Year entrants to be able to travel to a different city within the UPS network and really explore a different operational or non-operational role as part of the program. We believe this can be funded by the $3.2 million programming initiative that UPS has pledged to advance racial equity. Now that we've talked about the apprenticeship program and the rotational program, we would like to continue to address retention at UPS, and Kelly will share more details about that.
Thank you, Esther. The second half of our proposal consists of programs and a new digital platform that will address many root causes of UPS employee turnover. By implementing what we call the UPS Referral Plus program and the UPS Unified Rewards programs, UPS may be able to reduce turnover by 10% or more and potentially save as much as $150 million annually. As you can see from the slide, turnover at UPS is a problem, turnover in the industry is a problem, and turnover impacts Black workers, especially across the economy. So how can we bring turnover, especially for people of color, closer to the industry average, around 60%? The academic literature and practical successes that we've looked at suggest a robust referral program will help to extend tenure for new and experienced employees. We've designed a custom program for UPS we call UPS Referral Plus. Referral Plus is designed to reward both the referrer and the referred employee through four increasing tranches of bonus awards, culminating in a $500 bonus for both employees if the referred employee stays at UPS for a full year. The total cost of the program is about $1,500, plus a small per employee hour cost increase to manage the automated rewards and bonus platform that Khadija will speak to in just a moment. So how do referrals actually impact the size and cost of turnover? Well, when Dell completely re-engineered their talent program in 2013, a robust, standardized, and globally distributed employee referral program was a key driver of a 20% overall reduction in cost per hire for the firm. Referrals bring in workers that perform just as well, quit less, and provide a sense of community. And we believe UPS can achieve a significant cost savings with a robust program. As you can see from our scenario model, a 10% reduction in overall turnover could save UPS about $150 million. To enable the Referral Plus program at scale, we recommend that UPS implement a unified rewards and benefits platform that Khadija will speak to.
Thank you, Kelly. The UPS Unified Benefits System ties together the recruiting and retention programs that we've mentioned today. By offering a centralized system for all workers, that means seasonal, the recruiting participants, the part-time and full-time employees. The employees will be able to accrue rewards based on their performance, any nominations from their team, and the completion of professional milestones. Each of these rewards will meet their unique needs and have timelines that will be defined by UPS. We encourage UPS to make these rewards available immediately after the completion of onboard requirements, as well as more long-term. With a vested approach, as employees are with the company longer, they are able to accrue more rewards. So what are the rewards? Rewards will have different tiers, and it will include corporate swag, vacation and travel rewards, education and training support, cash bonuses, cryptocurrency, and gift cards, as well as additional time off. These rewards work together to address major concerns that the employees pointed out and demonstrate UPS commitment to employees' development and wellness. So what is the cost of such a program? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 40% of all U.S. workers have access to non-production bonuses. Non-production bonuses cost roughly 53 cents per person per hour. We recommend today that UPS spend approximately $1 per hour per employee, and this will bring the estimated total cost to $16.2 million, which is less than 1% of the UPS U.S. operating profit. Some potential concerns may be the need to implement a IT system that UPS may not be familiar with. As a result, we recommend that UPS use an employee rewards provider such as Wishlist that can offer customized packages and cover the IT infrastructure of this new reward system. So what exactly does this reward system look like for the average worker? Here you will see a screenshot. Consider Monica. Monica is a new employee. She has been with the company for a year, and she's excited to see what rewards she has accrued thus far. Instead of having to call her benefits manager, Monica can just log into her phone or either her laptop and look at all the benefits that she's acquired thus far. She can also view employees' accomplishments. She can send rewards to her colleagues if they've accomplished various milestones and just celebrate. All this together increases collaboration among employees and improve workplace culture. This underpins the idea that at UPS, everyone belongs at UPS. Next, we will have Kelly, who will speak to how we actually will market our programs.
Thank you, Khadija. We will utilize the You Belong at UPS campaign to bring awareness and action to our recruiting and retention programs. We'll focus heavily on digital channels where we can drive signups and submissions to our apprenticeship, rotational, and referral programs. And with a clear and well-funded marketing strategy, we will ensure that the potential, new, and tenured employees know that you belong at UPS. And with that, Esther, take us through some final thoughts.
Thank you, Kelly. This afternoon, we've shared with you four incredible programs. Under the recruitment strategy, we really shared about how UPS can get back to the history of UPS, recruiting young adults, and also recruiting populations of all ages through the retention program under the rotational program. Within our retention strategy, we've recommended an enhanced referral program backed by technology and innovative rewards, which in my opinion is better than credit card points. This is all important for people at UPS to stay longer at UPS. We, the Racial Justice League, believe the programs at UPS can improve both diversity and inclusion by combining both the retention and recruitment strategies simultaneously. This will enable both prospective and current employees to not only belong at UPS, but to grow with UPS. Thank you for your time, and remember, audience, we are the Racial Justice League.
All right. Well, thank you so much for such an incredible presentation. We're really inspired and excited to continue the afternoon. We're going to be transitioning into a 5-minute break. So get a snack, get some water, and be sure to join us back here at 2:50 EST. See you soon. All right, welcome back, everyone. We are so excited to transition into our next presentation. We're going to be moving into the technology track, sponsored by IBM and hosted by Cornell. Take it away, Team Javelin.
Welcome, everyone. We are so excited to be here today. My name is Vivian, and here today we have Josh, Anita, myself, Eva, Laura, and Nick, and together we are Javelin. Here, I'll just give a quick overview of our time together today and our plan to build a racial justice tech hub. We're going to go over why it's important we're doing this, why we've chosen our select city for the hub, the design of the hub, and our program's three initiatives, which include training and upskilling, collaboration for innovation, and closing the loop. Finally, we'll be reviewing how we're actually going to implement this hub in the real world. In 2020, the Black Lives Matter movement sparked an unprecedented wave of public support for racial solidarity from many corporations, including tech companies. These companies pledged over $4 billion for DEI initiatives, more than double the funds pledged in the past 6 years. Now, tackling racial injustice isn't just a one-time thing. How can tech firms tackle racial injustice for the long run, even when it's not front page news? And where can we help? From our research, we've identified three major areas of the racial tech gap. First, there's a skills gap that actually prevents BIPOC from entering the industry in the first place, leading to a lack of proper representation in the workforce, which thus leads to a lack of accurate product solutions being developed and implemented for these communities. However, we found that location can help close this racial tech gap. For example, studies have shown that when companies opened offices in cities with more Black representation, more Black talent was hired. While planning on where to put our hub, we identify four potential cities based on our research, then analyze them across five criteria to choose our final city. Atlanta stood out during the selection process, especially in the areas of demographic diversity, tech industry presence, and education. This leaves a lot of opportunity for a racial justice hub to have significant impact in Atlanta. For more data and details on our selection process, that can be found in the appendix. I've personally lived in Atlanta, and it significantly shaped my outlook on the power of community advocacy for societal change. I've seen the city come together during the Black Lives Matter and Stop Asian Hate movement, and believe it has the perfect ingredients for a racial justice tech hub to make significant impact. It's already a hub for underrepresented talent, especially as it houses the largest HBCU school network in the US. It's seen a recent explosion in tech investment and new offices, and is already a regional hub in the United States. And within Atlanta, we've even identified three potential office locations for a hub, each which would serve a very different community within Atlanta's very diverse population. An office in Beaufort Highway would primarily serve immigrant communities. Central Atlanta would maximize public transit accessibility across the city, and South Atlanta would serve a historically low-income neighborhood. And now I'll hand it to Laura to describe what our hub will actually look like.
Thank you, Vivian. So we structured the design process of the hub by first identifying the purpose of this effort, but also by digging deeper and detecting all the actors we wanted to attract and engage with. And then we spent a good amount of time crafting and shaping the actual hub, and we came up with a solution that involves both a virtual and a physical venue. I will be closing this section by providing an overview of this plan. But before we go to the next slide, I wanted to highlight that as part of the design process, that we came up with the same set of fundamentals that helped us during the ideation process. In general terms, we wanted to transform lives, true tech is our tool, and ensuring the hub is designed and implemented with and for the community. Early in our ideation process, we understood the critical role of the hub, of facilitating access to resources in the city of Atlanta for people of color. But to do that in an effective way, we needed to bring diverse stakeholders, not only tech professionals, but also local innovators, regional experts, community members, to think together about solutions to close the racial gaps in tech. This is a detailed table of the actors that we hope to attract together with the needs and our offering. We projected the hub's offering in a hybrid space that enables idea sharing, training, job matching, building out solutions, but more about the hub's initiatives in the next section. First, our proposal includes a calls for code virtual application that structures the participants' engagement with the hub. It will include the participant's profile, individual information about individual interactions with other members of our network, as well as information related to the HUBS program and events. This virtual platform will be available for web browsers as well as iOS and Android operating systems. A physical space completes our proposal, and we're envisioning an initial HQ in Middle Atlanta and future HUBS in the south of the city and Buford Highward. We established that the physical hub should be designed as a flexible, shareable, and community-based space. Our proposal embraces the idea of an open floor plan that offers both closed and open spaces according to the different nature of our initiatives. We have envisioned different types of spaces, and I will give a more specific description of two in particular. First, we have closed individual working spaces intended for personal work or processes involving maximum two people. They can be used for networking, informational calls, interviews, selection process, and assessments. And this is designed with accessibility in mind, with adjustable furniture and privacy. And finally, the multipurpose auditorium training spaces, which is an open space that can be used for the HUBS regular training program sessions, but that can be easily repurposed as an auditorium to host the speakers and presentations. I now hand you over to Anita, who will continue the presentation.
Thank you, Laura. So our primary objective when we were designing our programs was to design initiatives that were going to build off each other so that we could create something sustainable. We didn't want to create something that was going to be a one-time intervention. We really wanted the hub to foster continued growth as the community defines it. So the way we visualized our three programs is what we formally call our loop model, but informally the loop the loop. We welcome in members to the hub through training and upskilling so that they can unlock their individual technical and career goals. And then they move on to the second program, which is collaboration for innovation. Our hub is centered on the open source projects that are a current part of Call for Code's existing work, because this is representing how tech isn't just the end goal. This is actually the tool that we can use to create solutions. Then finally, our third program that completes this model is going to be closing the loop. So we're seeking to bring our hub members back to that central goal of building tech with purpose by creating support networks and fostering mentorship. When we began our research, it was incredibly clear to us that especially in the Atlanta metro region, there was a huge wealth of organizations that were already on the ground doing the work. And the last thing we wanted to do was kind of barge in and just reinvent the wheel. So we're focusing instead on leveraging a partnership approach that amplifies the work of existing organizations that are doing the work. And together we can fulfill our mission of eliminating that racial tech gap. In addition, our relationship with IBM is crucial because this also unlocks additional tools for us that have already been built, and we can use that to scale up programming and ensure really broad reach. So on this slide, what you're seeing here is a subset of organizations that we believe could be good partners for each of our initiatives, as well as IBM resources that dovetail in at each step. We have a more comprehensive list in our appendix. So to get into a little bit more detail about our individual programs, I'm going to start with program one, which is about training and upskilling. This is our initial program that welcomes in people into our hub. And this is going to be something that centers our learners here. And we are envisioning this as being a program for people who haven't had the opportunity to access traditional tech training resources or a formal academic background due to the leaky tech pipeline. And they're looking for a better career path. And in our case, in tech. So what we've outlined is a skills-based training program to provide our learners with in-demand skills, such as technical training, as well as broader business and job readiness, so they can succeed in a path of their own choosing. And this is all going to culminate in a capstone project that reflects the work of Call for Code and open source projects, and also brings our dedication of using tech for meaningful and community-sourced projects to the forefront. This also allows our learners to partner with more experienced technologists, like leaders who have gone through the hub already, so they can literally partner together to build something for their resumes, as well as addressing racial justice. So to deliver this training, we're going to, again, lean upon our partnership approach, and we're going to partner with existing orgs that have already developed curriculums for job seekers that are in Atlanta, as well as virtually from different backgrounds. We're also planning to leverage existing IBM resources such as Skills Build, and we can offer technical training that is more than code, expanding into in-demand categories like cybersecurity. So again, giving our learners their own choice in what they pursue. And the final piece of this program that doesn't sound like training at first is our provision for wraparound services. Switching careers is a really, really tough job. And going into a program without the support that's necessary doesn't set you up for success. And we want to be cognizant that time and money are huge barriers to participating in traditional boot camps. So childcare services and financial services can all contribute to center the actual person that's at the center of our program. So for each of our programs, we provide a list of research as well as pathways to impact that informs our approach, as well as some short-term and long-term key goals that we see as crucial for success. So for example, for training and upskilling, we're looking at how many learners we can provide this program to, or longer term, how many projects can our learners contribute to, and how we can scale up the work of our partner organizations as we aim to elevate everyone together. So to talk about pillar two, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Eva.
Thanks, Anita. Our second initiative is collaboration for innovation, and this closely aligns with Call for Code's mission and business model. One of our hopes for the sustainable programming that the Hub will provide is that the graduates of our core training program will be able to collaborate with tech professionals, local organizations, academics, and policymakers in developing technical products and conducting research that informs policy solutions. We've identified organizations that we can build relationships with across all of these industries and in partnership with existing IBM resources. The goal for both of these streams of effort is to further racial justice work in Atlanta and serve local communities through the tech ecosystem. At the top of the slide, we explain that our framework is centered around having a physical space, since this encourages community cohesion. This initiative will better position the Hub to engage with different community-based groups and ideas. This will create an environment where local government and organizations can engage to inform sustainable programming and economic policy, where technologists can share ideas with academics around improving inclusion and accessibility in tech, and where local entrepreneurs and founders can find mentorship and support in ideation and product development. And community members will certainly participate across all of these groups. At the bottom of the slide, we have some ideas for what this solutioning might look like. An example of a product is one that supports community initiatives, which are top priority, such as an app that empowers voters to find their local polling locations, which would help address the concern around a reduction in polling stations in the Atlanta area. In my previous work as a data scientist, I found that policymakers and academics are partnering closely with technologists to pass legislation that effectively prevents techno-racism. An example of research that the Hub could lead would be algorithmic auditing of the Atlanta Police Department's use of facial recognition to identify racial inequities introduced with the use of this software. Similar to how Anita discussed for the first initiative, we thought a lot about what constitutes success in the second one. This consists of two pathways to impact. The first, in which community members collaborate on open source products, and the second, in which academics and policymakers work with diverse community members. Both of these pathways make way for innovative products and racially progressive policies that will catalyze positive change in Atlanta and leave lasting impact. To this end, we need to ensure that our programs are effective, and we will do so by tracking both short and long-term metrics. The long-term metrics are related to monitoring the reach of our efforts, such as the number of people who use our products, and the productiveness of the Hub, such as the number of papers that we publish and the number of government policies that we help to support and inform. Now I'll pass it off to Josh to talk about our third initiative.
Thanks, Eva. The last piece of our three-part puzzle is centered around ensuring that the impact that we create is actually sustainable. We have called it closing the loop, and it consists of two components. The first is matching the graduates of our core training programs with jobs based on their unique skill sets and the needs of employers. This requires building deep relationships with recruiters in the tech industry to curate a diverse stream of jobs and opportunities for Hub graduates, enabling them to build fulfilling and impactful tech careers. The second core component is cultivating a thriving alumni network. Now, I'm sure I'm speaking for most people on the Zoom when I say that I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in today without the generosity of mentors in my network. We want to make sure that all graduates of our Hub have an opportunity to benefit from the experience of others and give back to a new generation of BIPOC learners once they graduate. We envision inviting Hub alumni to participate in our hackathons and to provide both formal and informal guidance to learners. In line with the principles that Anita mentioned previously, under both components, we hope to partner with other organizations to amplify our impact and theirs. For example, by working with IBM to place Hub graduates in IBM's apprenticeship program, and working with organizations with existing mentorship networks, like DevColor, to unlock more networking opportunities for alumni. As with the two previous pillars, we want to carefully track a set of metrics to ensure that our program is implemented as intended. We propose tracking the percentage of program graduates that get placed in a job, but more importantly, as you can see on the slide, we want to ensure that our alumni actually stay employed, they actually thrive in their job, and they actively participate in alumni network activities. Having described our programs, we'll dive into implementation. So this is a proposed staffing structure. The most important role here is the Hub Director, who is responsible for leading the Hub's day-to-day activities. We envision this person to be hired from the local community and to have deep knowledge about the community's needs. Under the director, we propose four manager roles. Just to highlight two, the learning and development manager you can think of as the lead teacher almost of the Hub, who will develop and implement the core training curriculum. And the engagement manager on the left here will manage relationships with employers and curate the job opportunities for graduates. At the top, we envision a Hub board, which will include current Call for Code staff, as well as a diverse representation of local activists, tech professionals, and policy experts. Now, we acknowledge that it will probably be quite difficult to staff all of these roles by the launch of the Hub. And so we propose prioritizing the hiring of the Hub director and then having IBM internal consultants temporarily staff the manager roles during the pilot phase of the Hub. I'll now turn it over to Nick to talk a little bit about the finances.
Thanks, Josh. Putting some dollars behind these proposals, we came up with the following draft budget for both the initial pilot program and as the center scales up. Possible funding sources to make this vision a reality span the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. As we mentioned at the start of our presentation, in 2020, many big tech firms made very large pledges towards advancing racial equity. Well, we believe this Hub is a great opportunity for these companies to make good on those promises. We see philanthropy, foundation grants, and government assistance as other crucial initial startup capital sources, along with IBM's own contributions as well. The financial impact of these capital expenditures will be charted and tracked through the varying programmatic performance metrics we identified earlier in the presentation. Let's go ahead and move on to the timeline. We envision a three-stage rollout for the center. Phase one will be our pilot program, with our initial participants being sourced from Atlanta-based employment assistance organizations. IBM will be naturally a first corporate sponsor and provide mentorship and educational resources. As I mentioned in the last slide, partnership with local nonprofits aligned with the Hub's mission is crucial to access additional funding opportunities from foundational grants and government assistance normally unavailable to corporations. In phase two, we aim to scale up. We hope our first corporate participants will have great things to say and through word of mouth and referrals, find additional participants to sign on. More corporate sponsors will be onboarded, especially those that have signed on to the racial equity pledge. And finally, we'll continue utilizing the impact metrics we detailed in our initiative slides and continually track the short and long-term impacts of the pilot program. Moving into phase three, where we think about future expansion, we hope at this point we have ample program alums and envision the center becoming a hub for local events, bringing together past and current participants, employers, and community members. We identified at the start of our presentation other areas of Atlanta that could be potential locations for physical expansion. We also identified other emerging tech centers and cities that are suitable for an eventual hub. Importantly, we envision continued performance tracking through feedback gathering to ensure we're maximizing the financial and societal impact of the center's work. So what will this rollout actually look like? You have here an 18-month long Gantt chart that we kind of devised here. It's color-coded. The first in the orange square there is the hiring of the Hub director. The following pink sections are our first cohort, or the pilot program, and they're color-coded according to the initiative that they correspond with. And the following blue section is for the second cohort of learners. And at the bottom, you can also see a mock schedule of events and programs that we feel like the program will be hosting, such as coding days and a hackathon. Great. So to wrap things up, we envision the center having a major impact on the lives of Atlantans, which is a city that we believe is uniquely suited to house this racial justice hub. Through our programs, we envision this hub empowering historically marginalized learners dreaming of entering the tech industry, providing them with the skills and network necessary to design and implement equitable solutions, and finally encouraging them to give back to future learners, creating a pipeline of leaders building products that accurately represent the needs and of their community. While we hope this proposal has been comprehensive, we recognize that there is always more to learn in this space. We must continue to listen to one another and welcome diverse perspectives. With this in mind, we have designed our loop proposal to be cyclical in nature. Our goal has been to avoid myopic solutions geared towards addressing just one area of the tech gap, and instead have focused on uplifting and empowering the community through this positive feedback loop of continued sustainable participation. We believe in the power of this proposal to change lives, and we hope you do too. Thank you so much for your time and for your consideration.
All right. Thank you so much, Team Javelin, for keeping it real in the name of racial justice. Before we move into our next break, I want to remind everyone that within the next hour, we're going to be launching our audience award, where you, the audience, will have the opportunity to vote on who you think should win the $10,000 award prize. So be sure to join us back. Come back at 3:15 Eastern time for our final presentation, as well as to prepare for the audience award. See you then. Thank you. All right, welcome back, everyone. Hopefully you've had an invigorating afternoon listening to these student presentations. To close out the finalist portion of the 2022 John R. Lewis Racial Justice Case Competition, we will conclude with a food and beverage track sponsored by Taco Bell and hosted by Yale. Here to finish us off strong, please welcome Bridging the Business Gap.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to kick us off with a quick personal story. I remember the day that I moved to Kansas from my home country, Nigeria, at the ripe young age of 17 years old. At the time, I was so eager to start my undergraduate studies at Emporia State University, and I dreamed of pursuing a career that would allow me to support my parents and four younger siblings. After my sophomore year, I recruited hard for internships, but what I discovered along the way would forever change my association to an understanding of corporate America. You see, at the time, recruiters often looked past my resume and my job interview performances. And through the various rejections that I got, I began to question myself, as I'm sure some people in the audience might have had at some point. Am I really good enough? Add that to the undertones of cultural differences and unconscious biases that were at play, and hopefully, maybe you can begin to get the picture. Nevertheless, fast forward 5 years later to present day, and I can tell you that I feel blessed and fortunate to be attending one of the top business schools in the United States because it has opened way more opportunities and doors for me than I thought were possible. Thankfully, I've already received offers from top consulting firms for the summer. But rather than be satisfied, I'm left wondering about how many other people who look like me have been overlooked in the past despite their character, despite their talents, and despite their unique life experiences. My own experiences have taught me that bright and talented people can be found anywhere, as long as we're open-minded and willing to look in, quote, unconventional or non-traditional places. I believe it's our responsibility as business leaders to continue to dismantle the invisible barriers that keep keeping minorities down. My name is Nkem Wogu, and my team, Bridging the Business Gap, are excited to talk to you today about strategies for how Taco Bell can expand its Black employee base and improve its brand positioning among Black consumers. But before we get to the exciting part of that conversation, I'm just going to quickly run us through our agenda for today. We're going to talk about four major things. We're going to talk about the background for the quick service restaurant industry, findings from our primary research, some recommendations, and then implementation and financial analysis. Starting off with the QSR industry and some of the challenges it's facing, what I actually want to draw attention to, given the statistics, are the dearth of Black executive and Black middle managers within the industry. Although the picture looks sad and a little bit bleak, we definitely feel that this provides Taco Bell with an opportunity to be a strong force in resolving this actual issue. Now I'm going to pass it off to Sid to talk about some of the data we collected for our primary research.
Okay. So we wanted to get a better understanding of both our target talent as well as consumer base. We were especially interested in gauging the current perceptions of working in the QSR industry and company like Taco Bell as a long-term career, and explicitly trying to identify the concerns. And on the consumer end, We wanted to get a better sense of what matters to the new age minority consumer and predict the effectiveness of our recommendations, both on a DEI front as well as a consumer loyalty front. And as you can see, we had three primary sources of data, including a large-scale comprehensive survey, five carefully constructed peer interviews with Black graduate students, and three expert interviews with industry leaders in the QSR space. So an interesting finding for us was that our target talent circled around a few key themes when asked what really matters to them. And they said words like honesty, trust, integrity, and flexibility, which is quite interesting. And we believe that this is especially true for Gen Z talent and will increasingly be an important aspect for companies to showcase in order to attract top talent. Our target talent also didn't explicitly or hadn't explicitly thought about working in the QSR space, which is also one of the issues that we want to address. And when we asked them what would have a positive impact on their perception and willingness to work at Taco Bell, three key themes emerged. A lot of people said clear path for upward mobility, education support, and a stronger diversity representation amongst leadership. And then when it comes to consumers, more than half of them, nearly 55% of respondents, said that their brand perceptions would change if they explicitly knew that some chains championed DEI while others were laggards. We asked them which brands in the industry came to their mind when they thought about philanthropy, and they listed out a few names. But what was really interesting to us was that they weren't really able to pinpoint a single reason for their choices. So we came up with the conclusion that it isn't going to be just one or two specific initiatives that drive brand loyalty, but it's going to be about having a built-in strategy of DEI and brand building efforts that go hand in hand and aim to create an ethos of both diversity and community in order to drive long-term brand loyalty.
A young and fun brand. That was one of the key perceptions of all our respondents, along with recognizing while it is hard to change brand perceptions in the QSR space, there have been many successful examples in the recent past. Other than this, there were three major takeaways we had from our primary research. It started with the cyclical approach needed for D&I. It needs to be both bottom up and top down. It needs to start right from the point of sale to the highest leaders of levels of leadership. Secondly, is the need for authenticity. Most of the respondents mentioned that if they feel the DEI efforts are authentic, they would be much more likely to spend money on that brand, along with recognizing the intangible benefits of DEI, including in better employee retention, as well as better quality of recent hires. And lastly, the loyalty aspect of D&I, which includes not only having a positive feedback loop of retaining employees, but also retaining customers that keep on coming back to the brands that they feel are authentically supporting D&I efforts. With these, we move on to the recommendations, and I hand it over to Gail.
Thank you, Harnoor. We're going to go ahead and kick off the recommendations first by providing a high-level overview of the key advantages and challenges of Taco Bell from an employment perspective. So firstly, to start with the advantages, DEI resources. So through internal meetings and our background research, it's really clear to us that Taco Bell is not only allocating resources to DEI, but that Yum Brands shares the same vision for a more equitable workplace. And we believe that the strength of this alignment is an incredibly helpful resource. In terms of a main challenge, something that we understood was that it's a challenge for Taco Bell to become more embedded and engaged in Black communities when the corporate office is headquartered in a relatively homogenous part of Southern California. And given that the war for talent is, you know, reaching an all-time high, it's more important than ever to really understand and operationalize what your employees truly want. So with that said, let's move into our key recommendations. And these recommendations are really tailored towards building the right internal structures in order to both attract and retain Black talent. Starting with flexibility. From a geographic standpoint, as well as in terms of work schedule, having flexible options for your employees is a highly impactful solution, especially when we think about the fact that 71% of Black women have caregiving responsibilities outside of work. And if we think about flexibility from a recruiting standpoint, we can also see that targeting commuters from Riverside or more diverse pockets of LA County and San Bernardino can also yield positive results. Next, moving into sponsorship. I want to first call out the use of the word sponsorship rather than the more common term mentorship that is usually used, just to highlight that the disconnect in Black advancement isn't really due to professional underperformance, but rather a lack of opportunity to get into the right rooms. A whopping 89% of employees felt valued by their workplace due to sponsorship programs, despite the fact that only 10% of firms actually have established programs. Next, moving into talent acceleration, we especially wanted to highlight this unique idea and opportunity for Taco Bell to essentially create its own pipeline of qualified talent from a more diverse part of the business. Taco Bell can provide leadership training to help train and skill high-performing restaurant employees in order to prepare them for a corporate role. moving in direct in internships. We strongly encourage building partnerships with more diverse academic institutions because it's a great way to diversify entry-level talent. And it's also a perfect entry point to start networking with alumni communities in order to diversify mid-level and senior talent as well. I'll turn it back over to Harnoor to elaborate on our proposed measurement strategy.
Anything that can be measured can be controlled. We recognize the complexity of measuring anything related to D&I initiatives. And for that, we have a four-pronged approach as a recommendation. We start with looking at diversity of employees versus the diversity of the application pool that comes in. We would want to measure the job satisfaction using happiness surveys and inter-team relationships, especially of the diversity groups. Next, we would want to look at the diversity not at just the organization level, but also drilling down into the deeper team level as well. And lastly, looking at job retention of various diversity groups, as well as the sentiment as they leave the firm. With that, I hand it back to Isaac.
Thanks so much, Harnoor. Next, we seek to build on our internal recommendations with external public-facing ones. Here, our main goals are to 1, create a reality in which Taco Bell is the preeminent quick service restaurant in the DEI space, and to 2, marry that with a national brand image that reflects that and ultimately caters authentically to, brings in, and retains the Black consumer. To do that, the first step is to implement real plans that create the reality that we are talking about. First and foremost will be the hiring efforts that were just outlined by Gaia. We believe that those efforts can and should be the cornerstone of Taco Bell's new corporate identity going forward. Next are 2 slightly smaller programs to emphasize this new corporate identity. First, we want to expand the Live Moss scholarship so that franchises partner with, support, and highlight the stories of local Black scholars in their store. Second, we want to support DEI-based hiring efforts outside of just Taco Bell. To do this, we hope to offer customers the chance to round up their tabs to support this initiative at stores and roll that out nationally. More importantly, we want Taco Bell to match those donations through what we are calling the Taco Match Program. Finally, in order to pair Taco Bell's new reality with national perception, we hope to take these efforts once established and highlight them through a community-focused, authentic national television media marketing campaign, which highlights the stories of Black employees and scholars. So next, given these lofty goals, we thought it was important to look at Taco Bell's current brand positioning. As it comes to advantages, Taco Bell has a young and passionate consumer base, which we see as a massive advantage here. Moreover, the consumer is demographically aligned with potential DEI-based marketing. Finally, we see open space in the QSR industry for a company that embraces an image as one that supports DEI and the Black community. As it comes to challenges, Taco Bell is currently positioned as a fun brand, but not necessarily a socially conscious one, but we hope to change that. Accordingly, we need to make sure that any marketing in this arena is authentic. And finally, these programs will require spend up front, but we do believe that there will be significant financial gratification in the long run. Finally, we just highlighted 3 QSRs who have pivoted to community-based marketing in some respect that Taco Bell can follow on particular aspects of their marketing. So with that, I'll pass it over to Max to discuss implementation.
Thanks, Isaac. Before we launch into the specifics of the implementation, we wanted to quickly reference a value analysis chart that pairs the complexity in developing each initiative with the financial gain and business value. First, if I could draw your attention to the bottom left quadrant, we have the sponsor program, flexible work arrangement, and the franchisee scholar program, which represent initiatives that are easier to develop, but are not linked to the highest financial value for the business. On the contrast, the right quadrant with the talent accelerator and community marketing show initiatives that require more investment, but we believe will drive long-term future business value. Next slide. Our first phase of implementation showcases 3 lower hanging fruit initiatives that can be completed and developed as soon as Q2 of 2022. Spearheading the sponsorship program pairs all Black employees with a minority mentor in their corresponding group. Apart from providing career trajectory advice and mentorship, we suggest working with the Black ERG group to identify additional areas that are deserving of the most attention towards sponsoring Black talent. This rollout can begin as early as May 22 with the marketing and tech groups. Next, offering flexible work arrangements focuses on an already relevant work trend as it relates to the COVID-19 pandemic. We recommend Taco Bell advocate for a hybrid remote model for corporate employees, mapping out the most diverse areas within neighboring cities and offering commuter benefits for office-required positions. The rollout will begin with the legal and finance groups in Q3 of 2022. The final immediate initiative works with pairing a formal partnership with historically Black colleges and universities, pledging at least one spot per internship class from universities like Howard that include a presence on campus and defined recruitment pipeline based on the initial rollout of these universities. We advise this tactic be rolled out to three additional universities in 2025. Our longer term investments represent initiatives that require more complexity in developing, but are additionally associated with driving business value in key hiring practices and Black consumers to Taco Bell. The Franchisee Scholar Program matches Black LiveMOS scholars with a local franchisee in their community and showcases their educational journey and passion for advancing their education. The rollout includes highlighting these stories at urban locations in Florida, Texas, and Georgia with a predominantly Black consumer base before rollout to future urban markets. Next, the Taco Match program will round up to the dollar on every food and beverage purchase to community-based organizations that support diversity and equity. The partnership will begin at 100 Southern California locations and highlights Taco Bell's continued effort to being a philanthropic leader in local communities. Our final recommendations represent the bread and butter of our initiatives. The Talent Accelerator program provides opportunities for high-performing Black restaurant employees to be enrolled in a leadership program with the chance to interview for entry-level corporate jobs. The program will be rolled out at Southern California Taco Bells within drivable distance to the company's headquarters in Irvine, California. Our final long-term initiative, community-based marketing, leverages the momentum of the LiveMOS Accelerator Program and Taco Match Program and highlights these efforts on selected ad campaigns tailored to Black consumers. These marketing campaigns will continue to push the image of Taco Bell as a leader in DEI while simultaneously driving Black consumers. I will now pass it off to Honor for the financial analysis.
While the value created by diversity is priceless, we have looked at the financial analysis of the various implementations that we have talked about. In the first year, we would be only coming up with the financial cost of sponsorship program and the partnership with HBCUs. And while going ahead in the next 5 years, we have looked at the financial impact of all the implementations that we have talked about so far. For example, the Taco Match program, which starts with 100 stores in the year two and eventually goes for a national rollout. All across the next 5 years, the cost of the entire running all of these implementations would be $8.2 million. But let me put that into context. What will this get us in return? Starting with, it would have at least 8 to 10 million in donations to community-based organizations promoting diversity using the Taco Match program. And in terms of the offset of the budget coming from which particular place, most of the conservative estimates that talk about what would be the financial savings of offering flexible benefits is at least $2,000. Some estimates going as high as $20,000, which would be manyfold compared to the budget estimate required for these implementations. With that, I hand it off to Gaya for go-to-market plan.
Thanks, Hanor. We want to end with a recap of our suggested programs, as well as provide a high-level view of what the next 5 years could really look like for Taco Bell in terms of our proposed internal and external initiatives. With that being said, we do sincerely want to thank everyone in the audience today for your time and this amazing opportunity. We had a great time building this, and we also want to thank the organizers, Gail, Emery, and all the other incredible people and companies behind this effort. Thank you again.
All right. Wow, y'all, what an incredible day. Thank you so much for hanging in there with us, for listening to all these inspiring leaders, for being a part of this incredible change-making competition. So the John Lewis case competition was really founded in the idea of enabling students from around the country to enact evidence-based and action-based bold ideas to move the needle of change in society at large. And we've seen that today, which has been incredible. While you've heard a lot of ideas and recommendations that have been tailored to specific companies, we imagine that there's a lot of opportunities for you to extrapolate those into your own businesses, into your communities, into your life at large. And for those that live at these intersections, we hope that you feel seen, amplified, and valued in the future of business. Talent from students around the world has been sort of, again, a key cornerstone to this competition. And something that's a really big differentiator with this competition is that all student winners that you'll be hearing about later this afternoon actually have to split their winnings with an organization that's on the ground doing racial justice work, and they've already identified them. So it's really a great opportunity to, you know, move the needle within these corporations and then on grassroots organizations as well. So you should be able to vote now. We welcome you, your family, your coworkers, your mentors to join in, tune in right now, vote for the audience award. This is $10,000 that's going towards these ideas as well as towards an organization that's doing racial justice work. So please vote right now. And then we're going to transition to the last part of our program. Thank you all so much.
Hosts and panelists can't vote.
I didn't let you do it.
Right. Thank you so much again, everyone, for such an amazing afternoon, listening to our student finalists, connecting with our competition community on our Slack channel, and voting in our audience poll award. It's been such an honor to walk with you through this day and in this work at large as we all seek to get into some good trouble in the name of racial justice. And with that, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the president of Emory University, Gregory L. Fenves. With a career in higher education that spans over three decades, President Fenves is a distinguished researcher and educator, as well as an experienced executive leader. He came to Emory in the summer of 2020, drawn by the university's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity. Please join me in welcoming President Fenves.
All right, well, thank you, Jasmine. I hope you can hear me. And my thanks to everyone joining us for today's final presentations in the John R. Lewis Racial Justice Case Competition. Now to our student teams. One word, amazing. Congratulations to Team Idea, Team Disruption, Racial Justice League, Team Javelin, and Emory's Bridging the Business Gap. To each team member, your insight and your creativity that I can see has gone into your projects is truly impressive. And your recommendations are exciting for your client businesses to make major efforts in diversity, equity, and inclusion in their companies, but also in their customers and for their customers and the communities of color that they serve to create a more equitable future for everyone. I'm proud that Emory's Goizueta Business School students have initiated this event last year, and this is the second competition, inspiring students, you, to take action, working with companies to create strategies that address systematic racism and injustice and to fuel lasting change. This actionable approach is named for the Honorable John R. Lewis. For 33 years, Congressman John Lewis represented Georgia's 5th District, which includes Emory's Atlanta campus. And not only was he our congressman, he was Emory's advocate, teacher, and friend. At the beginning of today's event, you heard from Ambassador Andrew Young that John Lewis had the combination of vision and courage. And what did he do with vision and courage? He rose to become a titan of the civil rights movement and a tireless advocate for social justice. Now, here at Emory, Congressman Lewis embodied our university's mission to serve humanity. His extraordinary life and dedication to protecting human rights and securing civil liberties for all people continue to motivate us today. Over the years, John Lewis engaged with and energized hundreds of Emory students, faculty members, and physicians. And we were fortunate to twice to host him as a commencement speaker. Now, I know you've seen it many times, but during his memorable 2014 speech at Emory, the congressman urged graduates to use their education to fight against discrimination, saying, and this is a quote, "Use what you have, use your learning, use your tools to help make our country and make our world a better place, where no one will be left out or left behind. You can do it. You must do it. It's your time." So to the students here today from more than 40 universities in this year's competition, thank you for fulfilling Congressman Lewis's charge. Your bold ideas will make a difference, a meaningful difference in the ways that companies advance social change, create inclusive opportunities, and support racial equity in their workplace and in their communities. And as I close, a big thank you to this year's corporate partners and sponsors. Thank you very much. And to the faculty, the staff, the student leaders at Emory's Goizueta Business School, whose hard work has made today's event possible and so successful. And now I'd like to introduce the next speaker, the competition's founder, Emory alumnus, Willie Sullivan, who joins us today as a judge. Willie, thank you for your vision and your courage and your tenacity in creating this outstanding program now in its second year. Willie, take it away.
Thank you so much, President Fenves. Can everyone see me?
Yes, we can.
Great. I am so overwhelmed with what we saw today. It was incredibly bold, creative, innovative, all of the things that whenever this idea first came to me and we made it happen here at Emory were exactly what we were looking for. We were looking for boldness and creativity to really take the energy that students across the country were saying that they had towards issues of racial justice and inequality. And I have to say, I think it's really actually so much more impressive and so much more important that we are here now 2 years almost since the racial justice protest of the summer of 2020, that we are having this conversation still today, that companies like Accenture and UPS and IBM and Moderna and Taco Bell are actually still having these conversations as the news cycle has moved on, as many politicians have moved on, as the protests in the streets have ceased. It is so important for us to continue talking, but not just talking, but doing what these students did today, which is coming up with solutions that can have lasting impact. It is about us continuing to show up until we start to see the world that people like John Lewis, Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, Rosa Parks, Mary McLeod Bethune, the list goes on, as well as our amazing speaker earlier today, Ambassador Andrew Young, had envisioned. It is up to us to continue to make these issues frontline issues, to make them business issues. We cannot, as Congressman Lewis would say, we must never, ever give up. We have to continue to fight until we see the world, the equitable world that we want to see. So I implore everyone that's on today, and many people have come on and left after they voted for their team. But for all of you that remain, I really implore you to take what you've seen today and be inspired by it. Don't just be inspired tonight or make a post on social media about how great it was. Really think about how you can take what you saw today or your own ideas and bring them to fruition and make something real happen. To all the students that participated, not just the ones you saw today, but to the hundreds of students that participated in this competition from the first round to this one, to the thousands of students that have competed over the past 2 years, please know that your work is not in vain, regardless of how you do in this competition. This is not about that. This is about doing things that are going to change the lives of millions of people in America and across the world. And I'd also really want to point out, from some of the things that I saw today, I love the focus, not just on corporate America, you know, those of us that work in offices or in my case, work from home, but on the people that are working truly on the front lines, the people who, because of their limited resources and access to education, have a limited scope of things they can do, to see some of the ideas from some of the students today that really focused on them and getting more people in the into a pipeline. Maybe it's not the conventional pipeline. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's about creating a new pipeline for people to get in and to be able to take advantage of all the opportunities in this country and across the world. Thank you so much for doing that. And lastly, I'm not here to do acknowledgments. I'm just here to be the hype man, as it were. But I would like to acknowledge all the work that has gone into doing this. All of the students at these four partner universities at Yale and Rice, Cornell and Howard, thank you so much for everything that you did and for believing in this vision. Again, to the wonderful sponsors, and then also to all of my Emory folks, you know, my immediate successor, you know, Keegan Baird, who's done so much, so much to make this happen, as well as our wonderful host and co-managing director today, Jasmine Burton, and the faculty and staff, our dean, Karen Sedetal, our faculty lead, Lynn Siegel, and also Jeff Rosenzweig. Really just cannot thank all of those people enough to continue this amazing work. Thank you all so much. And I say to you again, it is time to continue this work. It is not time to step away from it. If people want to move racial justice or racial equity to the back burner, you tell them no. We keep it front and center of everything we do. Thank you all so much, and excited to see who the winners are.
Thank you so much, Willie. So before I thank the many people who made this competition special and possible, I really want to thank Willie. So none of us would be here right now without Willie. Willie has spent countless hours to create this competition and even more sustain it. Over the past year, Willie has helped me grow as a leader, a teammate, an ally, and an advocate. He's been a mentor, guide, friend, and even therapist at times. And Willie knows all about that. So I'm so glad and so grateful that he trusted me and our team to grow and sustain this competition after the incredibly successful inaugural year. This has truly been an incredible experience for me and for so many others. So thank you again, Willie. Like I said, this event takes hundreds of people, thousands of conversations, emails, Slack messages, you name it. So I briefly want to thank everyone who made this possible before we announce the winners. So first, thank you, the audience. Thank you for being here and opening your hearts and ears to either new ideas or ideas that further your journey down your path to creating a more equitable society. I want to thank the amazing staff and faculty at Goizueta Business School, including the Goizueta Business and Society Institute, Goizueta Marketing, the development team, production support team, and the events team. I'd especially like to thank Professor Jeff Rosenzweig, who's also been incredibly generous with his time and connections to bring on amazing sponsors, like Accenture, for example, and amazing speakers like the incredible Ambassador Andrew Young. And thank you also to Natalie Allen for the excellent interview with Ambassador Young. I hope you all enjoyed that as much as I did. I'd also like to thank the Goizueta leadership team for supporting everything we do. Thank you, Dean Sedatol. Thank you, Dean Mitchell. Thank you, President Greg Fenves, your staff, and everything and everyone that has believed in us and to help us to get such great judges, speakers, participants, and really pull off this entire competition. Thank you to the competition leadership team, specifically at Emory, those who essentially do all the work that I get to take credit for. So thank you, Brian Russell, Karen Garola, Zod Adlu, Sonia Sharma, Brian Shepard, Kylan Bullock, Nikki Moore, Chanel Morgan, Natalie Werbe, Sadeg Azimi, and all of our first year representatives. There's too many to name. Thank you all. From the bottom of my heart, I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you to our fellow host schools of Cornell, Rice, Howard, and Yale. Thank you especially to their student leaders and their faculty who've been with us every single step of the way. I would also like to issue a public apology to the managing directors at each school, Pete Frazier, Raisha Smith, Kevin Waith, and Claire Masters. They've received hundreds, probably thousands of emails and messages from me over the past 6 months. So thank you all for being such great hosts and for really making this competition the success that it is. I want to thank Momenta.ai, the parent company of SurveyMonkey, for providing the student teams with the research budget that truly enabled these well-thought-out, realistic, and impactful solutions that you witnessed today. I'd like to thank Yahoo Finance for providing the pre, during, and post-event coverage and promoting this competition across the country. Many of you are probably streaming live from Yahoo Finance now, so thank you for tuning in. I'd like to thank our partner organizations in the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative University, which are actually sponsoring our winning team to go on to the CGIU event over the next year, a really cool initiative that we hope many of you all will apply to. I'd like to thank Instrument, who is here putting this amazing event on today. This event is much more than we could have done ourselves, and we cannot thank you enough for everything you've done. I'd like to thank Mixbag Media from our promotional materials that they used leading up to the event. I'd like to thank our collaborators from the Consortium, National Black MBA Association, Management Leaders of Tomorrow, the Roberto Toigo Foundation, and the Forte Foundation in spreading the word of the event and allowing us to have so many great participants, viewers, judges, speakers as we do today. So thank you to all those organizations. I want to thank our speaker, Andrew Young, who I had the pleasure of listening to before the event. You saw the 20-minute clip, but that was supposed to be a 30-minute clip, and it went on for 50 minutes, so we had to cut down a lot. So it was a really great conversation, and I wish we all could have witnessed the entire time. So thank you, Andrew Young, and thank you to the Andrew Young Foundation. I want to thank our judges, and not just the final judges who are here today. We have about 20 final judges judging the presentations you just heard, but we've had over 100 judges from across the country in fields of business, academia, government, nonprofit, you name it, throughout these three rounds of the competition. They've dedicated portions of their very busy schedule to make sure that the best teams advance and make sure that this competition is as impactful as it can be. So thank you sincerely, judges. Thank you to our corporate sponsors. You've heard from them today, but thank you not just for your monetary resources and sponsoring the competition and making this possible, but more importantly, your time. Our sponsors spend a significant amount of time developing the problem statements that these students work on, and then even more time ensuring the teams have everything they need to create bold, actionable solutions that will be implemented by corporations in the future. So thank you, Accenture, IBM Call for Code for Racial Justice, Moderna, Taco Bell, and UPS. Thank you. Thank you for believing us, for spending time with us, and committing to act on these very important issues. So thank you to all the students applying for this competition and making this competition possible. If we didn't have applicants, we wouldn't be here. So you've spent so many hours doing the research and are the reason we're here today. So thank you again for the time you spent on this and for your passion. I also want to thank Congressman Lewis and the Lewis family for blessing us to name this competition after legendary congressman. We cannot express our gratitude, and we are so grateful that we are tied to your name. Thank you again. And lastly, I want to thank my managing director, my co-managing director, and the MC of this event, Jasmine Burton, who you've been hearing from all throughout the day. I'm sure you can agree that she did an amazing job, and that's just a perfect example of all the work she's done throughout the year. So thank you, Jasmine. You did a great job. And now that's enough for me. That's the most I've talked in a while. So without further ado, let's get to announcing the winners. I'd like to hand it over to someone I've briefly gotten to know over the past year or so, who's been one of the biggest proponents of this competition. So with that, I have the pleasure of introducing Jerick Lewis, the nephew of Congressman John Lewis. Jerick, let's hear some good news.
Keegan, thanks for having me. Thank you for honoring my uncle, Representative John Robert Lewis, or as I like to think of him, Uncle Robert, by naming this competition after him and continuing his legacy. For those in the world, as we all know, he meant a lot to the world. He went and sacrificed his life daily for the betterment of others and the equality of the world. But for me and my family personally, he always wanted to put his focus on what family meant to everyone. He wanted to us to show love. He wanted us to show passion for each other. And last but not least, he wanted us to always unite as one. It's my family's privilege and honor to announce today's winner. The audience choice prize of $10,000 decided by all of you will go to the Racial Justice League from Georgetown University, representing UPS. Team Racial for Justice, to which racial equity organization do you plan to invest half of the prize money?
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for the audience vote. The Racial Justice League will be donating half of our prize winnings to Dreaming Out Loud, Inc., which is a local nonprofit in the Washington.
The second place winner.
It's a nonprofit in the Washington, D.C. area focused on food insecurity for people of color in the 7th and 8th Ward of D.C. Thank you again.
The second place winner will also receive $10,000 and has been decided by our esteemed judges. The winner is Bridging the Business Gap from the University of Southern California, representing Taco Bell. Team Bridging the Gap, to what racial equity organization will you be donating half of the prize money?
Thank you so much. We will be donating the half of our money to an organization called 110, which is dedicated to Black advancement.
The 20,000 grand prize winner of the inaugural John R. Lewis Racial Justice Case Competition goes to Team Javelin from Yale University, representing IBM Call for the Code. Team Javelin, to which equity organization will you be donating half of this prize money?
Thank you very much. The organization that we are supporting is Black Women Tech Talk, that provides business growth support and facilitates access to capital to Black female founders. We believe in investing in underrepresented tech founders is the best way to mitigate the gaps that we highlight in our presentation. Thank you very much.
Congratulations to these winners. My uncle, Representative John Robert Lewis, will be so inspired and proud of the work you have all done. Congratulations. Keegan, back to you.
Thank you, Jerick. Thank you so much, Jerick. Thank you, everyone. Congratulations to all the winners. That's an incredible prize. And we're so glad that you get to donate half of your winnings to an organization advancing racial justice in America today. So I encourage everyone to head over to finance.yahoo.com, where we'll be live streaming an interview with the winning team at 4:30 p.m. Eastern time. That'll be a really exciting interview to hear about the team's motivations and what they plan to do with both the prize money and their recommendations. So again, thank you, everyone. No matter your role in this competition, we appreciate you extremely. We hope this is not just a one-time thing. We hope you stay engaged. We hope you join our Slack, follow us on social. We'll be doing this again, and we can't wait to be there along with you on your journey. So thank you so much again, and have a great rest of your day and weekend.